The Guardian.
I'm very clear that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. A series of presidential tweets cause an unprecedented diplomatic incident between Britain and the United States. As Trump appears to endorse anti-Muslim videos shared by a far-right UK party, should his state visit go ahead? Plus, Britain and the EU are close to agreeing how to calculate the divorce bill. But has Theresa May got value for money? And will her party's Brexiteers back it? Meanwhile, we look at the next looming issue that won't be solved by money alone. What to do about the British-Irish border? But first, in the early hours of the morning, a 41-year-old woman in Bognor Regis received an angry tweet from the President of the United States. It read, "Don't focus on me, focus on the destructive, radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the United Kingdom." Donald Trump quickly deleted it and copied it to the correct Theresa May. It was the culmination of a chaotic presidential day on Twitter in which he'd shared anti-Muslim videos from a member of the far-right Britain First party and been criticised by the Prime Minister's spokesman. Well, I'm joined now by Brendan Cox, whose wife, Jo, a hugely popular and passionate Labour MP, was murdered by a far-right extremist who shouted the words Britain First. So tell me what you think Donald Trump has done here.
I think we've all become used to this president and his behaviour, you know, the outrage that he stokes, the fact that he uses that as a distraction strategy. But even bearing all of that in mind and all of us already having an incredibly low bar for him, I think that the retweeting of these far-right fringe groups, the hateful content of the things that he retweeted, you know, this group which is led by convicted criminals, people convicted of religiously aggravated harassment, I think it does set a new low, even for this president. And I think that the reaction to it has been actually one of incredible unity. I think the right across the political spectrum in the UK, I think people were aghast at this and don't feel that it was the right thing for the president to do. But also, I think more fundamentally than that, I think people understand that providing a microphone to these types of views has a real impact. Hatred, when you feed it, has real costs. You know, my family are just one example of that. And there are many other examples in our society. And so I think that the condemnation comes from the fact that the impact of his words is to legitimize a set of views, is to make people feel less stigma in being bigoted, racist, Islamophobic, and that will also mean, you know, what the actual impact of this is it gives license to people. People feel they have license to act on that hatred. What we know from the social science around this is that when people are in an atmosphere where this kind of hatred is seen as being socially unacceptable, the likelihood of people following through and doing anything about their hatred is reduced. And when it becomes mainstream, when it becomes vindicated, they're much more likely to take action on it. So I do worry that the impact of this is not just diplomatic absurdity and is not just embarrassing and stupid, but actually will have a real impact on hatred in our communities.
And Brendan Cox was by no means the only one reacting furiously. Jeremy Corbyn called the tweets abhorrent, dangerous and a threat to our society. London Mayor Sadiq Khan reiterated his call for a planned state visit to be cancelled, saying the president would not be welcomed in Britain. And Cabinet Minister Sajid Javid, also with Muslim heritage, said Trump had endorsed hate-filled racist organisations that hated people like him. The Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, also said the tweet was wrong, but that people should focus on the bigger picture of the US and UK's close historic relations. Now I'm joined on the line by Brian Klass, an LSE fellow who has advised US political campaigns and is author of The Despot's Apprentice, Donald Trump's Attack on Democracy. Brian, we often talk about the special relationship between Britain and America, but we've never seen anything quite like this, have we?
No, we haven't. And the special relationship is extremely important. And it's the, you know, Britain is the closest ally for the United States on the global stage. But if you think about how the relationship was forged, it was largely forged defeating fascism during World War II, with British and American soldiers dying alongside each other on the beaches of Normandy. And now you have a diplomatic feud where the House of Commons is debating whether to revoke a state visit invitation to Trump because he promoted the views of a neo-fascist group in Britain. This needs a very clear rebuke, because the British government cannot stand and just simply stand alongside Donald Trump as he spreads these unbelievably hate-filled views of a fringe extremist group here in Britain.
And you talk about that. I mean, for a lot of people, Donald Trump has been quite extreme, but this takes us to a new level. What does it tell us about his psychology?
Well, I think he is either extremely unstable or a racist bigot, or both. And, you know, this isn't a terrible shock to me in the sense that I've been following Trump closely for 3 years now. During the campaign, he retweeted white supremacy groups multiple times. He could have claimed ignorance, but nonetheless, he did retweet them. And he also, after the Charlottesville attack, when neo-Nazis marched through a town in Virginia and then murdered a peaceful protester, he said there were very fine people in that protest march, which featured neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klansmen. Now he is also talking about how, you know, he's spreading these tweets from Britain First, the deputy leader of which has been convicted of hate crimes for inciting religious hatred, and who appeared on Radio Aryan, which is a neo-Nazi radio show. And then if you even think about just this week, on Monday, he used a racial slur denigrating Native Americans. He attacked black athletes on Tuesday, and then he spread these anti-Muslim videos on Wednesday. At some point, you just have to understand that this is this person. This is who Donald Trump is, and anyone waiting for him to turn a corner or become presidential is going to be waiting a very long time, because he's 71 years old and we're just going to expect more of the same from him.
And how has this all gone down in the US? Is it seen as one of his usual Twitter outbursts, or, you know, is there a chance that he remains so popular among millions of people that he will be reelected?
Well, so among his base, this is wildly popular, right? There's a segment of the American population, particularly the sort of Steve Bannon wing of Donald Trump's party, the Republican Party, that is anti-Muslim, and there are some people in that wing of the party that are extremely racist. And for those people, they're absolutely cheering, right? I mean, this is why you have people like David Duke, who's an ex-Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, tweeting in celebratory terms about Trump sharing these videos, the same way that Jada Franson, the Britain First deputy leader, was celebrating yesterday. But, you know, for the broader American public, this is completely out of step with our values. You know, the country was founded on the basis of people being persecuted for their religious beliefs, and now you have the president of the United States persecuting religious minorities from his official account. So, you know, he is the most unpopular president in polling history. This will further alienate people who already dislike him. But for those who have supported him through and through, this won't change much. And I fear that this won't change much in policy terms, because Republicans are soon to vote on a major tax bill that will be a major victory if it passes for Trump. And, you know, it's more of the same, where people will say, this is wrong, we don't agree with the tweets, and then they'll vote to advance his agenda. And I think, you know, until people actually say, we're not going to send you any legislation until you take down those tweets and apologize, or Theresa May to say, you can't come to the UK until you take down neo-fascist tweets and apologize. I think at some point, basic decency needs to overrule the strategic short-term interests, both in Congress and in our key allies.
That was Brian Klass. Well, I'm joined now by Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and by writer and commentator Andrew Lillicoe, one of the few British economists to openly back Brexit. In fact, he chaired the Economists for Britain group. We'll come on to that in a minute, but staying on Trump first. Polly, I got home last night and I felt a little sick, and not just because I'm pregnant. I felt a little sick because this was extraordinary. Essentially, the US president, the most powerful person in the world, appearing to incite religious hatred on Twitter, and certainly not backing down from it today. I mean, am I overreacting?
Not at all. I think the whole world would be overreacting, should be overreacting. It is disgusting. It is an attack on all Muslims everywhere. It's a religious war that he's trying to start up. He's obviously using it to excite his base. But there must be a lot of people who know very well that, you know, the main the people who were attacked most by ISIS and Islamic extremists are, of course, other Muslims. They're the ones who've died, you know, in hundreds of thousands and millions. And the idea that we should be having a kind of crusade is terrifying. It's even more frightening that all of the people surrounding Trump, nobody stopped him. Nobody says, enough, you can't go on tweeting like that.
In fact, Andrew, his spokeswoman came out and defended it, saying even if the videos are unverified, the point he was making was reasonable.
Well, I think that made things even worse. That's right out of the Goebbels playbook. And it's just absolutely unconscionable. The whole thing is appalling. That he's I'm sure that the way it started was that he didn't have any idea who Britain First were. He'd never heard of him. He just thought that was a bit like America First or something. And he's endorsed by his careless RTing and by, and even just the content of the videos alone was appalling, even regardless of the source. But then he's picked a terrible source. He's then doubled down on it by saying it doesn't matter if it's false. He's then attacked the British Prime Minister over her criticism of him for it, as if saying, oh, she should mind her own business. Appearing to be entirely unaware that the fact that he endorses far-right anti-Muslim hate groups in the UK who have almost no penetration in recent years into the UK political scene, that by endorsing them he risks inflaming anti-Muslim hatred in the UK, legitimising hate groups in the UK, and thereby assisting their Islamist counterpart. It's just, it is to do with us. It's an attack on us as well as an attack on Muslims all over the world. It's just an absolutely appalling situation, and it's unbelievable that we've come to this with the United States.
Theresa May has been criticised at times for not being hard enough on Trump. We are now seeing a reaction from the British government that this is unacceptable. Sajid Javid, the community secretary, tweeted some pretty strong stuff. There's been a letter from a Conservative MP, Nadeem Zahawi. Does that sort of hearten you somewhat, Polly?
It certainly does. And I was very glad that Theresa May responded promptly and without having to be prodded. He can't possibly come here. There's no way that Trump could or will, actually, because he knows perfectly well there will be massive demonstrations.
But of course, the government are not saying they're going to withdraw the state visit.
No, they should, but they know it won't happen. It can't happen.
Do you think that's the thinking, or do you think they are very, very nervous, Andrew, about our relationship with America, not least in the light of the fact that we are going to be moving away somewhat from our European partners?
I don't think he's very likely to come anymore. I mean, there wasn't actually that much of a problem when he went to France, and people didn't object that much around Europe to the fact that he'd gone to France.
I mean, that was before he had done something like this. I mean, psychologically, this takes him into a new level. You were talking about perhaps a comparison to Marine Le Pen.
No, absolutely. I agree. I mean, I think it's difficult anymore to claim that Trump is not really, that he's any more mainstream than Le Pen anymore. I don't think he'll come to the UK, but I don't think that it's necessary for the UK government to inflame the situation further by formally cancelling the visit or anything of that sort. I think he's not going to come, and we should be seeking to express our disapproval of him very firmly, but we don't want to be escalating this into even more of a row than it already is. I think it's bad enough already.
And he's reacted very strongly to originally Theresa May and Bognor Regis, but now Theresa May, the Prime Minister. I mean, how much of a diplomatic nightmare is this situation? And although, Polly, I know you would like us to stay in the EU, you don't want us to be thinking about one-on-one trade deals with the US. That presumably is something that a lot of people will still consider to be very important in the future.
It's always looked almost impossible anyway, because Trump's whole point has been to say no trade deals except on our terms. We know that means just at its most basic level accepting American food standards. We won't do that. They won't change their food standards. It's not going to happen. It's a fantasy, the idea that we're going to have this fantastic trade relationship with America anyway. I mean, this just makes it that much more obvious.
Oh, well, we are slipping smoothly from Donald Trump's tweets towards Brexit here. Andrew, I know that you want to respond on the point Polly just made on trade.
I think that there probably will be a trade deal with the US, because I think that the underlying economic interests are going to be more powerful than the diplomatic difficulties of Donald Trump. But
You're relaxed about those chlorine-washed chickens.
We'll work our way through. Of course, there are various issues. There are things that we want that that they won't like, and things that they want that we won't like.
No, but they've said we will have to accept their agricultural standards. That's what they've said.
There's points of debate, and of course there are things, and people say all kinds of things before negotiations.
But of course, Michael Gove himself doesn't want to accept that.
Let's not negotiate a UK trade deal here. I think there will be a trade deal. But I think coming back to your deeper point, with leaving the EU, there are some people who maybe imagined that the US might be a new geopolitical partner for us in a post-Brexit world. And I've never thought that that was really a goer. I think that the US is not that much like us culturally or politically. And I also think that that this situation is just another illustration that the US doesn't really respect us enough to be that kind of deep geopolitical partner in the future. So I think we'd have to look elsewhere.
Okay. Where? China will disrespect us even more. India, they want loads of visas. We're not going to give them. The idea that as a little minnow all on our own, we're going to get a better trade deal than the whole of the EU gets with these countries is for the birds.
Well, I think that there will be a deal with the United States. I don't think it's true that we're a minnow. I think we're the fifth or sixth largest country economy in the world. And I think that the natural partners for us are people with whom we are more culturally and politically aligned, namely the Canadians, Australians and New Zealanders.
Okay, well, long before we get to those trade deals, we've got to talk about a few other things. Because ever since the Brexit referendum was announced, a key argument made by the Leave side was always going to be about the money. Britain is in a minority of the 28 members who are currently net contributors to the EU, to the tune of not quite £350 million a week, but about £8 billion a year. Now we're hearing that a deal has been struck that should meet approximately the £50 billion the EU has been asking for. And the payments will be made, a key phrase here, when they fall due. So, Andrew, rather than telling Michel Barnier to go whistle, as Boris Johnson once suggested, it seems we're going to cough up. Does that blow a hole in the argument to leave?
No, not in any way at all. First of all, I've long advocated the idea that as part of a general overall settlement, we ought to have a series of payments which would amount to of the order of 45 billion euros. That's been the position for some time. In fact, I think that was effectively what the British government was signalling from some months ago and repeated in the Florence speech. It's the EU that had turned down that offer to this point because they had insisted that we had to agree to pay the money, regardless of whether we got the deal at all. So their position was we had to accept that we owed them the money and that it wasn't as part of any overall deal, including a trade deal and transition deal and so on. In fact, the EU on Tuesday, the Guardian and the FT and the Telegraph reported that that was what had been agreed by the British government, that it agreed that the payment should be unconditional. If that had been so, I would be sitting here calling for the Prime Minister to resign. There would be a whole queue of Conservative MPs calling for her to resign as well. Fortunately, the Prime Minister has denied that, and in fact, they've gone further. Yesterday, in the House of Commons, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury said that any payment made would only be part of an overall settlement that was acceptable as set out in the Florence speech. And if that's not true, if they've lied to the British government, that will be the end of the Chief Secretary and of the Chancellor and of the Prime Minister.
Okay, but can I just push you on one point there? So, okay, they're saying nothing is agreed till everything is agreed. The problem is that by March 2019, when we Brexit and in doing so agree to the divorce arrangement, including the financial bill, we will not have a detailed trade deal. We may have the principles of a trade deal. So are you happy to say, as long as there's a nod to the principles, that we should be paying that money?
It was always going to be the case that the exact details of the trade deal would need to be honed in any transitional period afterwards. So that was always clear. Provided that we have the heads of agreement, provided that we have the basic core parts of the trade deal agreed, I think that's fine. There's always going to be a few little details to sort out afterwards.
And what do you make of this agreement, Polly?
Well, the go whistle Brexiteers have had to meet reality.
Just to be clear again, that's Boris Johnson we're talking about.
Boris Johnson, who said, go whistle, no money. They didn't put on the bus that we would be paying some £50 billion over many, many years. That's not what it said. It's not what people voted for. I think the fact that the Brexiteers themselves have had to accept it doesn't necessarily mean that the British people will. And when they see the whole deal at the end, why are we paying so much in order to deny ourselves our most important markets, I think a certain reality may creep all the way through those who voted for Leave.
Well, do you think that you could actually shift the opinion of the country as a result of this?
Well, it is shifting already. If you look at all of the last six months of polls for YouGov and for several other pollsters show a slow, very slow but steady movement towards people saying, actually, they think it was the wrong decision. You know, another 6 months, it'll move further. Who knows? It needs to get to something like 60-40 before politicians would dare to think again. But it's heading that way.
And Andrew, we talk a lot about the bus, the 350 million. We also talk a lot about what you might see as the misleading claims of the Remain campaign, the punishment budget, the immediate recession and so on. Given that there was so much misleading information on both sides of the debate, would you think it would be acceptable if public opinion shifts as we start to see what the deal really is going to look like, to go back to people and say, let's have a referendum on that final deal?
The discussions about money, of course, are a discussion about how much less we pay. So the divorce bill isn't about paying extra as a consequence of leaving. It's a discussion about the rate at which we taper off the payments which we would have been making to the EU anyway. So I don't think that there's really that much of a problem in that regard, provided it's part of an overall deal. If there's any sense that we're just paying things for nothing, I think that there would be a significant problem with that. And in fact, the deal might be voted down. And if it weren't voted down, there'd be a chance that it couldn't just go through with Remain MPs supporting it and Brexit MPs opposing it, for example. That would mean probably a pro-Brexit government later down the line that would renege on whatever was agreed. I think there's no chance whatever of any second referendum. And I think that whilst it's absolutely fine if people argue once we've left the EU that we should rejoin, I think the idea that having had a referendum that we then wouldn't actually leave would be a very serious matter for British politics. Because if you can't have a general election, elect Jeremy Corbyn, and then say, well, we don't like the results, so we're going to have a second general election and see whether people really meant it. Once you have decided something...
Except you do have one 5 years later.
Yes, absolutely. But that's after you've already had a Jeremy Corbyn government. So once we've left the EU, it'll be absolutely fine to have some further arguments, other referendum, whatever you want to do for us to rejoin. But we can't now not leave having had an election to decide that we were going to leave.
And Polly, on this point, we had a big debate, a Guardian Live event last night. Can Brexit be stopped? And we had Gina Miller and Alistair Campbell, I suspect, on the same side as you. And we had Gisela Stewart and John Mann on the other side. And one of the issues that was clearly rumbling on was, even if there is a change of opinion, the chances of that happening in time for this to be stopped before March 2019 are pretty low. And then if at that point you wanted to rejoin, you'd be talking about a completely new set of rules, essentially entering Schengen, entering the Eurozone. There's no chances there that the British public would ever vote for that.
I think it's very difficult. It all depends on timing. For all we know, there could be a sudden general election 6 months' time. The Tory party is so split, so disloyal to one another, it could suddenly happen, kind of by accident. More likely, they'll hang on to the bitter end for 3.5 years, by which time we'll probably be out, but possibly not. There is a possibility that we could still be in a position where at that point Labour could say, you know what, I think we'll take the Norway option, we'll take the EEA option, and we'll stay in the single market and the customs union. We will still Brexit, but we'll be with the Norwegians and others.
And one more question on the divorce bill, but first let me just put that to you, Andrew. Would the British public maybe be able to accept something like a Norway option?
Look, in principle, All we've actually done in the referendum is vote to leave the European Union. So any form of leaving the European Union would be politically legitimate in a way. I think that if we were to just go for a Norwegian-type option, that wouldn't be accepted for very long. And what would happen, it wouldn't be politically illegitimate, but what would happen is then you'd have an enormous movement for us to leave from that in a second phase. So we'd do a kind of Brexit 2 5 or 10 years later.
OK. And just on the divorce bill, I mean, the 2017 general election changed the maths in Parliament, and that has certainly changed the tone around the debate on the EU. And next week, Labour MPs putting down amendments which could say you'd have to vote to agree to hand over the money at the end of the process. Polly, what are they hoping to achieve by that? And would you see Tory Brexiters perhaps voting against the divorce bill at that stage?
I think what they're hoping to achieve is what the Brexiters always promised, which is sovereignty to Parliament, which this government time and time again has been trying to deny in every kind of way. And I think they're just insisting that each step of the way, Parliament should decide how it works, what we pay, and all the rest of it. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if some of the Brexiters rebel. I suspect not enough of them, a small handful.
OK. And Andrew, do you think the parliamentary mathematics has changed the type of Brexit we'll end up with?
It's made some difference to the negotiations. It might have meant that we end up with giving the EU a little bit more money than we might have done otherwise. And it might mean that the transition period is a little bit more extended. I don't think it makes a huge difference. It would be quite risky to enter into a situation where the final deal was passed with pro-Remain MPs passing it and most pro-Brexit MPs voting against it. If that were to be the situation, I think you should expect that then be a follow-on new political movement to undo some of the elements of the deal in a kind of UKIP 2, if you like.
What chaos. What utter chaos.
Absolutely. That
what
would
insanity.
Be chaos. And so let's not do that.
You look at all of the problems facing us, facing the world, you look at Donald Trump, you look at crisis after crisis, and here we are wasting probably at least a decade of British energy, political thought, imagination and money on something that all we're trying to do is to limit the self-destructiveness of it.
Well, if these reports on a deal over how to calculate the bill are accurate, and neither the EU nor the UK are denying it, the next question will be, has there been sufficient progress made in order to move the talks onto the thorniest of all issues, trade, and the ongoing relations between Britain and the EU? One of the main stumbling blocks is the question of Ireland. The border, the economy, and the Good Friday Agreement all require much more than just money to get over the line. None of it has been helped by the prospect of a collapse in the Irish government, narrowly averted this week. A Northern Ireland assembly that has been suspended. And not to mention the ongoing troubles faced by the UK government. Well, we're joined now by Tony Connolly, the author of a new book, Brexit and Ireland, and Europe editor for the Irish broadcaster RTE. So, Tony, you're right in the thick of this. Just give us an overview of where we are with the negotiations and whether it's true, the reports we're hearing, including from The Guardian today, that we're getting close to a breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, I think things are really intensifying at the moment. At official level, there have been talks the last few days between British and European officials. Irish officials have had a more direct input into that process in the last 24 hours as well. And the whole thrust of this now is to get solutions on all three problems over the line in time for Theresa May to meet Jean-Claude Juncker on Monday. But I think it's fair to say that the Irish issue is the most delicate and tricky of all three, and it may be that they don't actually get the Irish issue over the line in time for Monday, which poses, I think, a bit of a dilemma for the EU task force. Do they separate off the Irish issue, saying two out of three ain't bad kind of thing, or do they say no progress on one means no progress on all three? So that's a judgment call, I think, that Michel Barnier will have to make next week.
I love the way that you just dropped a meatloaf line into talk about Brexit. I wonder who noticed that.
I've been trying to do that all week.
So one thing I've got to ask you is, how seriously do we take threats from the Irish government that they could veto trade talks? I mean, what the British government sources would say is, hang on, to solve the Irish issue, we need to move on to trade talks.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a few things. The Irish government has been trying to nuance the whole idea of veto quite strongly in the past couple of days, saying it's not an Irish veto. It will be essentially an EU27 veto. The Irish position on this is aligned with the EU27, and it will be the EU27 that decides whether or not there's sufficient progress. On the second point, of course, everyone knows that the Irish border is to do with trade. It's to do with customs and tariffs, but also to do with checks on animal products, on food products and so on coming across the border. And yes, that is a phase two future framework trade agreement issue. The key point the Irish government would make is that what we need is sufficient progress. Nobody expects to solve the Irish dilemma before the European summit in December. What is needed, according to the Irish government and to the EU27, is sufficient progress so that there is an assurance there for the Irish government that whatever happens post-Brexit, there won't be a hard border on Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement will be protected.
And Brexiteers pointed to the possibility of technologies, you know, number plate recognition, computerised checks that could be used to try to maintain a soft border, even if you have to bring in those checks. They say that those work in other parts of the world. I mean, do you think that is fanciful thinking or something that could be a realistic option?
Well, certainly it's been looked at, and there was a lot of traffic going to the Norway-Sweden border, where they have got the latest in technology. The license plates of lorries are scanned. A driver can get a text on his mobile phone saying his electronic document declaration has been approved, and he just has to go in and out. To the Irish government, though, that is still a hard border. That still requires infrastructure. That still requires delays. And you have to understand the nature of cross-border trade in Ireland. There are haulage companies that might get an order to bring stuff to Dublin from the north of Ireland, with that afternoon. Then they have to get declarations organised. They cost money. The whole question of a supply chain, rules of origin, they will all come into play. So essentially the government in Ireland and also the EU27 in the shape of the EU task force have said, look, technology like that is not going to work. It's not going to really solve the problem. And it is magical thinking is the phrase that the European Commission used when Britain's paper on this came out in August.
And Andrew, Tony was talking there about the Sweden-Norway border, because of course Norway is outside the customs union. But not long ago, I interviewed the Foreign Minister of Sweden, Anna Linde, and she said to me that the number one complaint for Swedish companies was trade with Norway. They find the border actually quite difficult. Do you think that for Brexit, we will have to accept that there will be, if not a hard border, something quite different from what we have now between...
No, not at all. The British government position is that for our part, there won't be any hard border. So
how's that possible?
Just regardless
of
whether
the customs union,
regardless of whether there's a trade deal, regardless of whether there's any deal with the EU at all, there will not be a hard border with between Northern Ireland and the South. So that so the exact details of how that would work, you can only work out once you know what the trading arrangements are that you're trying to deal with. To what extent are you talking about needing to achieve regulatory compliance? To what extent are you talking about collecting tariffs of various sorts? To what extent is there variation in VAT or other things of that sort? So we can only go on to say exactly how you would resolve those questions once you have the idea of once you have your trading arrangements agreed. But a key point to understand, I think, is that a hard border is used by most countries because that's the most convenient way for them of collecting taxes and checking regulatory compliance. But it isn't the only way of collecting taxes and regulatory compliance. Within the UK, we collect taxes and we make companies comply with regulation all the time. Millions upon millions, 5.5 million companies in the UK, without any of them ever crossing a hard border. We have all kinds of other mechanisms for doing that, whistleblowers and audits and all kinds of ways that we check that people comply with the law. You don't have to have a hard border in order for people to comply with the law. And so the idea that that's an absolute necessity if we leave the single market and customs union, I think is just wrong.
Polly?
I think you can kick it down the road now. You can say, all right, we've got an absolute pledge from the Brits that there will be no hard border. Fine. But when you get further down the line to the trade agreements and you can start work on them, you are still going to come up with a hard crunch against this problem. There is only one way to resolve it, which is for Northern Ireland, and because the DUP insist on it, therefore the whole of the United Kingdom, to stay in the single market and stay in the customs union. That is the only way you can have a soft border, unless the DUP, which is very unlikely, suddenly crumpled and said, oh, all right, we'll have a different arrangement for Northern Ireland and a hard border with the rest of the UK. I can't see that happening.
And Tony, Polly's kind of putting that in the context of the political parties north of the border, and clearly they want very different things. Is there any possibility that we would have a situation in which Northern Ireland would either remain in the customs union, despite the rest of the UK exiting, or have some different regulatory deal with the rest of the EU that the DUP would be comfortable with?
Well, to explain a little bit why this has emerged, this idea of Northern Ireland remaining in the customs union and single market, we have to look at the way the negotiations have been going in Brussels. And during the summer, It was agreed that British and EU officials would go through the Good Friday Agreement in forensic detail to look at the impact of Brexit on the whole nature of cross-border cooperation, which is obviously a key component of the Good Friday Agreement. And the idea was to see, you know, at what level is there a complication because of Brexit? And they discovered that there are 142 areas whereby that cross-border cooperation is complicated or disrupted by Brexit. One area of cross-border cooperation is health. There's a lot of cross-border healthcare. People from the Republic can go to Belfast and Derry for heart treatment. People from the North can go to Dublin for specialist cancer services for children. All of that activity is underpinned by harmonised regulations on medical devices, on ambulance services, on the regulation of medicines. So that is why when you break it down, you see that the operation of the Good Friday Agreement depends quite a lot on the harmonisation of regulations. So that is why the Irish government and the EU27 are effectively saying, look, in order to preserve that, it makes more sense for the whole thing to be convergent on either side of the border. I think the British government would say, okay, that's fair enough, but let's look at it in practice and perhaps have bilateral arrangements for each specific area where there is disruption. The EU will tend to say bilateral agreements like that are way too complicated. They would take far too long. They are legally dubious. A better system would be that Northern Ireland remains within the structures of the single market and the Good Friday Agreement, the Customs Union. And I've been told that by senior officials in the European Council that that is legally doable. It is technically doable. The problem, of course, is that politically it is very fraught for Theresa May and the Conservative Party because, of course, they depend on the DUP. And also Conservative backbenchers who are quite attached to the idea of no dilution of the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain.
But are we inevitably, Andrew, heading to a situation where there is going to be some difference between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK? And if so, do we end up in a situation where people will start referendum demands?
So I think we need to distinguish between different things. I think it's not just about the DUP. As Tony rightly said, it would be unacceptable to the Conservative Party for Northern Ireland to be remaining in the customs union and in the single market whilst the rest of the UK left. On the other hand, there is devolution of various sorts within the United Kingdom. So Scotland has some powers to set income tax in different ways, and Northern Ireland has its own regional assembly. And it would be feasible to empower the regional assembly in Northern Ireland to determine its own regulations in certain areas. I think that having a comprehensive agreement to remain within the single market would be entirely inconceivable. I think that giving the Northern Ireland Assembly the discretion to decide that it could set its own regulation in this or that aspect of agricultural rules or something of that sort, which ease the path to cross-border cooperation in the context of a trading agreement or other kinds of arrangement with either with the South or with the EU as a whole. That all of that would be much easier. I don't think any of that is particularly problematic, but I think that it is important that we move on to know where we're going to with this. I don't think any of this is a real blockage. And I think that the idea that we have to resolve all of this before we can move on to trade talks is both getting things in the wrong order and actually just a completely unnecessary blockage being raised.
But Polly, this is an incredibly complicated subject, which we didn't really talk about during the referendum. I mean, is this the sort of thing that could start to change people's minds? And, you know, we remember the troubles. Do you worry about the Good Friday Agreement and peace in Northern Ireland?
I do, and I think a lot of people will. Of course, the, say, solid 30% of absolutely adamant hard Brexiteers will say to hell with Ireland, because they're the sort of people who've often said to hell with Ireland. Why? How can the tail be wagging the dog, they'd be saying. But I do think that the other 60% of the country would say, for heaven's sakes, look what we went through. Look what Ireland went through. Do we really want to reopen that wound all over again when things have been going better and better year by year in relations in Ireland? You know, is it just because the government's propped up by the DUP that we're going to have this obstinacy? I think it'll be yet another thing where people say, nobody talked about that. Nobody told us that. And another reason why people will feel it's legitimate to think again about the decision they made.
Tony, can you finish us off with a prediction on this? People really don't want there to be a hard border between North and South, but do you think it's going to happen?
Well, I would pick up on a point that Andrew made about, you know, the Northern Ireland Assembly having, you know, new devolved powers to figure out its own regulatory relationship with the Republic of Ireland. The problem is that the EU will regard the UK as a third country after Brexit. And the EU, on all its borders with third countries, has to apply checks and controls to protect the integrity of the single market and the customs union. So that will be the same for Northern Ireland. And the way to look at this, I think, is that you could have a scenario in Northern Ireland where goods are produced that are not subject to EU regulations. They can pour into the Republic of Ireland if there aren't border checks. And from there, they're free to make their way around the EU single market. It's important to remember the other 26 countries will not accept that. French farmers will not accept agricultural products from Northern Ireland that have been produced not subject to EU regulations that their farmers are subject to. So that is why they will insist on a clean and legally sound arrangement. So they won't accept a more pragmatic, you know, free range agreement that Northern Ireland can produce in through the Assembly. They will want something that's legally sound and that will protect the integrity of the EU single market.
Well, you can follow all our reporting on this at theguardian.com/politics. And that is all we have time for. My thanks to Andrew Lillico, Polly Toynbee and Tony Connolly. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anish Gristana. Thanks for listening.